listening to a young woman as she is trying to establish boundaries in a relationship, which is complicated, and that relationship might not be good for her. But how does she do that in a way that's not mean? And at the same time, we don't want, at a certain point, girls being in relationships with people that are consistently violating their boundaries. Girls often have to show respect to somebody they don't, specifically because that person is abusing power and trying to take away the dignity of someone else. I am never going to tell a girl that you have to respect the actions of that person, but I'm always going to tell that girl you have to treat that person with dignity.
IQ. We all know what that is. Intelligence quotient. How smart we are or aren't. IQ is associated with success in school and work, creative achievement, genius potential even. It gets a lot of focus. But do we know as much as we should about EQ, our emotional abilities and social skills? While our IQ measures our cognitive and analytical skills, it's our EQ that we rely upon to regulate our emotions, to provide motivation, and frankly, to get along in a world full of others who don't think or feel like we do. While our high IQ might mean we are competent, our high EQ will mean we know how to successfully navigate the relationships that are so important in life and how to express our feelings usefully and productively. So it's easy to see why a girl's EQ is every bit as important as her IQ. It matters to her ability to relate and engage with the world around her. And the girls in our lives need to relate and engage to stay mentally, emotionally, and physically whole. The good news? EQ, emotional intelligence, can be strengthened through reflection, practice, and experience. Today, let's get smart about being emotionally smart. The girls in our lives need us to know about this. Before jumping into our conversation, let's hear from some girls on what they have to say about our topic today.
When I think of the term social and emotional learning and what it means is it's social emotional learning is the development of people's emotions and not just the academic aspect. I feel like one thing that kind of messes up a little bit of social emotional learning is social media, because I feel like sometimes when you get different things on social media of posts and people think it's different people saying stuff, it could just also be AI generated and it's not actually contacting with people.
What sort of social skills do you think are critical to getting along both at school, but then later on in the workplace? And when I ask that question, I think more of the fact that sometimes we know people who are very what we call school smart, and yet you shake your head and you think to yourself, boy, I'm not sure if they're going to make it out in the quote unquote real world.
I think one of the most important social skills to have is an openness for collaborative discussion and just an openness to that diversity of thought. When you're in a school setting, especially in a private school, people are coming from all different areas. It's just so important to be able to take everyone's individual experiences and all of their perspectives to kind of broaden your own.
I think a lot of the social skills that are critical to getting along at school, especially in all-girls school, is confidence, but also understanding that a lot of the times confidence has to come from a certain degree of competence. So knowing that, knowing your worth, but also not under or overvaluing it.
I'm Trudy Hall, your host for The Connected Girl, a podcast series produced by the International Coalition of Girls' Schools and part of the On Educating Girls series. Today, we're learning from Rosalind Weissman, a woman with a great deal of EQ, who speaks, writes, and consults on the topic of social-emotional learning, the author of 9 books on related topics, and a sought-after public speaker. She works on the global stage as a senior leadership consultant at the U.S. State Department's Office for Overseas Schools, which serves over 195 schools throughout the world. The link to her website will be in the episode notes so that our listeners can do a deep dive into the substantial resources she offers and see if she's speaking at a location near them soon. Rosalind, I am so looking forward to the conversation we're going to have today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I always like to start at the beginning, Rosalind. So will you take us back to 2002, more than two decades ago, and tell us a bit about your original inspiration to write Queen Bees and Wannabes, now available in its third edition. What prompted you back then to dive into the world of adolescent girls and write a book about the power and tension in girls' friendships?
Well, as bizarre as it seems now, when I first started out, when I was 21, 22, and I was working with girls, and I mean, it seems like, I mean, it was a lifetime ago, and I started off by teaching girls self-defense. That was something that I had gotten very involved in when I was in college. I was really struck when I was listening to them, because I, of course, I wasn't just doing like self-defense with them and teaching them the skills of that. We had to process it, and we would sit around and we would talk about what that felt like to be able to be empowered in that way and to be able to really learn skills that were fundamental to girls and their physical safety, but also their emotional safety. And as we talked, it became very clear to me as I was listening to them. And honestly, I was maybe 4, maybe 5 years older than a lot of the girls that were sitting around that space with me, that they were talking a lot about their friendships with girls and the complexity of their friendships with girls. And all of a sudden it was like, you know, the curtains parted and there was this stage in front of me of there's this whole world that we're not seeing and it's right in front of us. Or maybe that it's right in front of us, but we're not seeing the import of it, the consequence of it. And it just became so clear to me that what girls were learning from their friendships, for better and for worse, was impacting their emotional and physical safety, and that we needed to be able to really bring to the surface what girls' friendships were and the complexity of them and how they were learning to navigate conflict and support each other and trust each other, that we needed to talk about it and that it was this thing. It was just right in front of us. And so I did that work for years, teaching what we now call social emotional learning. I didn't have a word for it. I don't think any of us did. And I did it with the girls. I really partnered with the girls. I would look at them and see if what I was doing was working or not. And I've always been very, very acutely sensitive to girls' expressions on their faces and their body language about whether they are resonating with what I'm talking about or teaching or facilitating. So I started writing lesson plans. And then really the thing that happened is that I wanted to be able to talk to parents and teachers after I was done talking to girls. And so Queen Bees and Wannabes was really about being able to put in one place everything that I was seeing and learning with and from the girls.
And so as you think about the work that you did and you talk about the way it unfolded over years, what is now different or changed? Are you sensing that there are different issues 2 decades later?
Well, I think that there are evergreen issues, and for better and for worse, I don't know how people will feel about that if they hear that, because I think a lot of people have said to me over the years, like, aren't we ever going to get beyond this? And they have their own interpretation of what this is. But what is evergreen is that young people develop and that they have to navigate and learn how to navigate conflict and how to go through the process of their adolescent development. And part of that is learning how to negotiate, enter and leave groups and enter and leave friendships and advocate for yourself and advocate for other people. And that is not going to go away. And what's also not going to go away is being betrayed by a friend or betraying a friend or telling a secret that you shouldn't have or somebody doing that to you or comparing yourself to other people. Those things are evergreen. Some of those things are heightened now, certainly because of social media and technology, but not just because of the girls' interaction with technology and social media. It's also very much about the adults in their lives, their interaction with social media and technology, and then putting their issues on girls. So it's not just the girls. It's really also the adults putting our baggage on girls because we compare the girls in our lives to the other girls that we see on social media. And then we put that on the girls in our lives. So it's not just about the girls. It's also about all of us. And so there are evergreen issues. And at the same time, of course, for example, there was privacy when I first started working with girls, and now there really is not. But I also think that girls will always seek to create privacy, even in the very public nature of their lives.
Well, as you and I start to talk about this conversation, and I think you're leaning into this space now, I do agree. I think that right now adults are playing very different roles in girls' lives. In particular, parents are playing very different roles in girls' lives. They're more frightened for their daughter's well-being, and so they're interacting differently. You offered up a very compelling piece of wisdom that I want you to explore with us, and I wish our listeners could see my hands, but you pointed outside yourself, and you said what needs to change is not out there. And then you shifted your fingers and you pointed to yourself and you said, what needs to change is in here. And you were suggesting that we contemplate the stubborn persistence of these issues in the lives of girls and women. And you're leaning into that now. You know, it's our job really to think about that differently. Can you talk about that more?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I've realized and I am doing a lot more work on is what I call the invisible operating system, which is the things that you learned when you were growing up and you were literally learning for better and for worse about how to navigate conflict, how to speak up, how to not speak up. When did you have permission to do so? When did you not? How you navigate when you're feeling intimidated or when you feel like you're self-righteously in the position of being able to and this is actually something that really concerns me today about when are you in the right to be able to be self-righteous, be so angry that you get to just do whatever you want to other people, that your own sense of your ethical compass sort of goes sideways when you think that you're quote unquote in the right. And so I've really been doing a lot of work on this invisible operating system and how, as women and men, of course, as we people get older, we take real crucible moments that we had when we were in adolescence and learning about what it is to face power or to be in a position of power. And we take those moments and they become part of our operating system and they sort of lie dormant to ourselves or not obvious to ourselves. But when there's a moment of conflict or a moment of insecurity, that they really come to the fore. And one of the things about parenting, for better and for worse, is that it brings out sometimes a lot of our baggage and a lot of our anxiety and a lot. I mean, it's an opportunity of immense growth, personal growth, and self-reflection. But it also can be very easily a time when we convince ourselves that because we are parents or because we are doing things for the best interests of our daughters, that we do things that are actually not in the best interests of our daughters. And we can get really confused by that. And for me, that's one of the complexities that I'm dealing with. And I think we're all dealing with, frankly, when we are working with young people in an educational setting, is that the adults have to manage themselves. And we often think that we've gotten beyond sort of this, what we would call teenage behavior, when in fact, when there are moments of power and of conflict and of insecurity and intimidation, we revert back to these ways of being that we learned long ago.
This makes so much sense to me. And I love this notion of the invisible operating system because it helps me conceptualize it even within myself as I'm talking to you. You had me traveling back to my own childhood to imagine some of my own invisible operating systems. And so I know that you will not be surprised when I ask, what is our role in unpacking this for the girls in our lives? What are we supposed to be modeling differently, having that explanation at the top of mind?
Well, one of the questions I've been asking adults a lot right now is, how did you learn to speak up for yourself? And I've been doing it in corporate settings and in educational settings, and people get very like, oh, wow. And I have to say, like, it's not going to be a therapy session. Like, we're going to be okay. My role, my job is to take the feelings and experiences that people have and put them to words and to work with people, to listen to people. And I define listening as being changed by what you hear. So to really listen to people and then be able to create the words that people can then visualize, right? Like the invisible operating system or girl world or, you know, queen bee or all the taxonomy that I created, again, for better and for worse, right? Because that's a whole thing, right? Of the taxonomy that I created really is a better and worse situation. So when I think about what are the responsibilities that we have to young people and to girls, is that I believe, as in my position of leadership and in my position, the platform I have, but I think, and I think we all have this responsibility, is to be relentlessly mindful of our actions and how we're coming across to others. And at the same time, be self-compassionate and not take ourselves too seriously, give ourselves some space to make mistakes. And to also admit the challenges of all of this. It's not like I've said that and I'm really good at it. Right now I'm struggling with, oh, I haven't written all these things I need to write and I'm falling behind. I mean, of course I am. But I think that we need to be really clear about the struggles that we're having, but appropriate about it, because we can't put all of our stuff on kids. No children want to hear like these long drawn out stories about, for the adults in their lives, about like their last horrible, the divorce that they just had, right? Or kids will laugh and tell me about the teacher or the presenter who comes to them and talks to them way too much about their kids or about their personal lives, because young people want a little bit. They want an appropriate amount, an appropriate share, so that they understand the values of the adult that's in front of them. They want the adult to be the adult, to have a healthy boundary between themselves. And right. And so we have to be mindful, right? We have to be mindful about how we're coming across. And I also think we have to be mindful about, and this is really important, and this connects to the work I just finished with David Yeager and his book 10 to 25, is that we really have to be mindful that what we are saying is not what we think should motivate them. We have to really think about what we're saying actually does motivate them. And the only way to do that is to be honest about how we're coming across and ask them, right? Ask them how we're coming across and not do it in a way where we're just expecting like get some polite answer. That we actually ask young people who are not interested in giving us the right answer what they really think. And I just think it's one of the most important things, because we often are saying things like healthy choices, or I mean, so much of the language we use with girls is just so counterproductive, because it's just so awkward. So we have to listen to them to be able to create our own communication.
Well, you've put two words side by side, and I think they belong together, you know, relentlessly mindful. I think the notion of mindfulness is really critical in what you're talking about, but I also think, obviously, the ongoing relentless nature of it. You can't just do this once or have one conversation with your child. You've got to be constantly thinking about, okay, well, how did that go? And what do I need to ask her about? And how do I get her feedback on what we just talked about? And so having said that, we know that we need to tap into how girls are feeling. You've just noted that it's really critical to get their feedback on how we're doing. But sometimes the systems and the structures that we have in place in either our homes or school don't work as we intend them to. So there's a tension between a young woman using her voice and a young woman, as you suggested, becoming self-righteous. Can you help us explore that tension a little bit more?
There's a lot of tension between girls having a voice and also developing the skills to be able to integrate other people's opinions into how they are seeing the world. And it's a really complicated thing to do. And it's really, I think, a lifelong journey of trying to figure this out. I mean, I'll speak for myself, that I certainly have had situations where I have dominated the conversation because I felt that I was in the right. And I feel very strongly about the things that I do. And, you know, I was doing this work when I was fully doing this work in my early 20s. And, you know, throughout my career, I've been blessed that this is the only career I ever had, is to do this kind of work. So I certainly know the feeling of like, I have strong feelings, I have strong opinions, and I have the right to speak those opinions, which absolutely, I've spent my entire career wanting young people, not just girls, young people to be able to have that. And at the same time, it is also about rights and responsibilities. And we sometimes struggle with the responsibility part. And we focus on, we want children to have the right to have opinions, especially our daughters. But they really do need to balance it out with the responsibilities they have to listen to other people. And that includes, by the way, boys and like other people. And one of the things that I'm really concerned about, and I've been concerned about this for a very long time, let me be clear, is that as long as I've worked with young people, there have been young people, both boys and girls, who have felt that they had the privilege to dominate and silence other people. And that often very much can be connected to the economic class that they're coming from and the combination that they have of like gender and class, where they are in their community, that gives them a voice to dominate other people. And so as somebody, as a parent, and I'm a parent of two boys, and I have struggled a lot with one of the main responsibilities I feel as a mother of two young men, and I've had to do both consistently throughout my parenting journey, is to teach them about being able to listen to other people. And at the same time, they have definitely had experiences where girls have said to them, you can't speak because of who you are as a boy. You don't have the right to speak. I just had this conversation with my older son a couple of days ago. And the feeling of I can't speak because I will be drowned out by girls is a real experience that some boys have. And it does not take away from the pervasiveness of sexism that girls experience. It does not take away from it. We do not live in a binary world. We try to, but we don't. And because we try to, we often miss out so much on how to actually be able to solve for some of the problems that we have. So two things are true. Girls need a voice and need to have that voice celebrated and affirmed and reinforced. And the other part is that is not 100% always the case, that they also need to be able to create space for other people, their peers, all their different kinds of peers, to be able to listen to them. And navigating between the two is the responsibility I think that we have as adults. And that is not a one-shot deal. That is something that we are going to be continually having conversations with the young people in our lives as we guide them. And sometimes they're going to be in situations where they get dominated, and sometimes it's going to be the other way. And we need to be able to be there to help them navigate both sides.
So let's get practical for a moment. I think you and I would both agree that developing emotional intelligence is like a muscle. They have to continue to work on it. And the more they work on it, the better they get at using these skills. And so they need a skill set that helps them navigate the terrain you just talked about. They need a skill set that helps them hear no. How do we do this? What are phrases that are useful? What are techniques and strategies that you have seen work?
Okay, there's so many ways to answer this. So when I first started working in schools, I noticed that the word respect was everywhere. And it still is, by the way, and it really irritates me. And that might be strange for people. Like, why? Why does she have such an issue with the word respect? Because the word respect is not used honestly in schools. And so respect actually in Latin means to see again and to admire someone's actions, to literally see someone and to say, I admire what they're doing. And the reality is that in schools, it is often used as a way to demand obedience and compliance for young people, especially young people who do not have power for whatever reason in their schools. And that could be class, it could be race, it could be religion, it could be ethnicity, it could be all different kinds of reasons. But respect consistently, and I work around the world, has been used really dishonestly. And I want people to use the word respect, absolutely, in schools. I want young people to respect me as their teacher, but it's because they know and can see that I have worked hard to be able to deserve their trust because I work hard at my craft of teaching and I listen to them and want to make their education relevant to them and that we're in a relationship of learning with them. And so respect is a really complicated word in schools. And so I use the word dignity as well, of recognizing the inherent worth of someone. It's not something that's earned or lost, it's a given. And so to give you some specifics on that, I want us to think about that when a girl, for example, comes to us, and then I want us to think about how this connects to our complexities of raising girls as educators and parents. Is a girl comes to us and she's 10 years old and she comes to us and says, you know, another girl is being mean to me on the playground. And it's really common for teachers and parents to say, you don't have to be friends with that girl, but you do need to treat them with respect. And the way that that girl hears that is that they have to be nice to that girl, that they have to go along basically with like what that girl is doing to her. It's the way girls hear it. Because when you're telling somebody you have to respect them, it means that you have to show that you're being, whatever the word is you want to include in that, kind, go, you know, be able to show them the way that you want to be treated, all of these things. But think about that for how girls are hearing it, which is I have to go along with somebody who is violating my boundaries. Why are we telling girls that we have to go along with someone who is violating their boundaries? And the other part is girls hear that and they think to themselves, I can't go talk to these adults. I am confused by what they are saying, which is understandable. So instead, if we can say, you don't have to respect that girl's actions. I'm never going to tell a girl that she has to respect the actions of a boy who is ridiculing her or sexually harassing her, or a girl who is saying horrible things to her on social media. I am never going to tell a girl that you have to respect the actions of that person. But I'm always going to tell that girl, you have to treat that person with dignity. And then I'm going to work with that girl to define what that looks like. And so being able to split those words apart so we have the power of each in our vocabulary with girls is profound, because girls often have to show respect to somebody they don't, specifically because that person is abusing power and trying to take away the dignity of someone else. I do not want to teach girls that they have to do that, because that silences them in the face of an abuse of power. So, and I don't care if it's their peer group or if it's an adult, it's the same dynamic.
I really like the distinction that you're making between respect and dignity. I'm now hearing that very differently, and I'm imagining how we have used those words in the past. I especially am interested in the language, the way girls hear things, because I think we don't think about that often enough, you know, how things land on a girl, how she may be perceiving what we're saying. So connecting those two ideas is really important for me to think more about. If we were going to channel the voices of girls that you know right now, and they were hearing our conversation, what would they want the adults in their lives to know about their struggles? You've talked somewhat about this, because you talked about how it lands and how they interpret it, but would they then have feedback for us?
Well, I just was talking to I think she's 15. She might have just had her birthday, but here's an example that I was actually having dinner with her, and I was, this is one of those moments where I'm like, oh my gosh, I love my job. Where she was describing a situation that is, by the way, evergreen, where she's in ninth grade and she has a friend who, for various reasons, needs a lot of attention. And that's not a bad thing, right? It's one of the things I have to tell girls all the time, is that we will say, oh, that person needs attention, as if, you know, and then when we say that, that allows us in our minds to dismiss that person, right? Like, oh, they just need a lot of attention. Well, the person needs attention, and maybe that's aggravating and annoying, but there's a reason why they need it. And at the same time, for girls especially, we need to help them establish boundaries with people that need a lot of attention, the people that are their friends, because in this thing of wanting to be supportive to somebody who needs a lot of attention, a girl can violate her own boundaries, right? It's a really slippery situation. So this girl was talking to me about her conflict with this friend, and this friend was starting to lie about things and exaggerate, and she felt like she was getting lost in the friendship. And so the girl described this other person as sour coating everything instead of sugar coating. And I thought, that is brilliant. That is so brilliant. Listening to a young woman as she is trying to establish boundaries in a relationship, which is complicated, and that relationship might not be good for her. But how does she do that in a way that's not mean, right? Because we teach girls not to be mean. And at the same time, we don't want, at a certain point, girls being in relationships with people that are consistently violating their boundaries, or they're going to be in situations where that person, for whatever reason, right, is going to make decisions that make them vulnerable to unhealthy, you know, choices, which is a word I really don't like to use, but appropriate in this situation. And girls get really we all get confused about how much support do I give somebody else, and what does that look like? And where do I begin and end? And where does this other person begin and end? And so when I'm just talking to girls about these situations, to be, you know, concrete about this, is that to be able to say to them, what are the three things that you have to have in this friendship, right? So this is a complicated friendship. So what do you have to have in this friendship? And what can you not have? What are the things sitting here at a quiet time where it is absolutely too much? Because for girls to be able to establish that and that criteria whenever they can, but with an adult who's not going to be like judging them, but just walk them through this process of thinking through it, is that they can actually create systems for themselves so that they can listen to themselves in the moment when they need to. And remember, I define listening as being prepared to be changed by what you hear. And girls need to be able to listen to themselves in really important moments like that.
Oh, you give me another good definition of listening, being prepared to be changed by what you hear. So as we think about change, and I always like to move to a moment of hope in any kind of conversation I have with a guest, I've heard you make the comment that so much of the social behavior we see in girls stems from the historical reality that women have not had traditional paths to power, that we often need to use these ways of being to get to the place of power. So I think these roots are deeply embedded. I happen to agree with that statement. What do you see as a hopeful sign that the young women you work with are changing in this regard? And are we shaking those roots?
What I love about this generation of girls is that they are open to seeing themselves in different ways. They are open to seeing other people in different ways. I think they know in a lot. Also, what I really admire and respect about them is that they, in large part, know what they're up against in so far as like what social media is doing to them. And they will admit, like, Instagram makes me feel less than, and I still am going through it and scrolling. And they can talk about the challenges that they have, I think, more easily than previous generations. And they are more open to being able to say, you know, I'm struggling with X, I'm struggling with Y. So for me, the hope is really in girls being very open about being curious to change the situations that they're in that they don't like.
So you bring so much wisdom to this topic, Rosalind, and I know our listeners would like to keep some of your wise words in their head as they sign off and dive back into their busy lives. Can you leave us with 2 to 3 ideas or phrases or important notions that you want them to keep in front of mind as they contemplate what they heard today?
You know, I just had a high school girl say something to me that was, again, this is another girl that was so funny and so true. She was critiquing a situation that I was writing. It was for an advisory scenario. And we're really struggling at the school with trying to improve the way that young people are interacting with each other. So I'd done this thing where we had created these lesson plans and there were scenarios in it based on what the students had told me. But then I wrote the scenarios and then I asked them to, and I wrote questions for those advisories. And any educator listening to this will know exactly what I'm talking about. So I did these little questions and then I had them give the feedback. And I had this girl say to me, and she put it in the notes in the Google Doc. And she said, okay, I really don't want to be rude because you're an adult, but can you please not ask me or ask any of us how people feel or how the people are feeling in these situations, like after you depict the scenario? Because it feels like we're 5 years old when you ask us about how the person feels in the situation. Can you instead just list all the people that this impacts, the situation impacts, like the scenario you're describing? Can we list all of the ways, like all the people that this impacts? And then have a discussion about that. And I thought, yes. And I looked at it and I thought, obviously, because you've been asked how people feel since you were in second grade, you know, in these kinds of situations, and you are so tired of being asked that. And actually, it's a way better question to ask, what are the ways in which different people are impacted? And then we can get to emotions later, because emotions are clearly incredibly important. And so one of the things, actually, that's the first thing. Second thing I would say is connected to emotions is it's really important to say to girls, and I think we do the first half, I don't think we do the second. Emotions are real. No one gets to say to you that your emotions aren't real, right? We're pretty good on that one in the girl world with educators and parents, like your emotions are real. No one has the right to question how you feel about something. And emotions can change. They can pass. You can move through your emotions. That second part, we don't focus on as much. And I really worry about that, because we need to give girls the confidence that, yes, you can have your emotions, and those emotions can be very strong. And those are real. And you have the capacity to move through them so that you can calm yourself down, you can process them, integrate them, and then you can think more clearly. And I think we really need to focus on the second equally to the first.
Very good point. What you're saying is what I love in life is yes and situations. And what you're saying is we can create yes and out of this topic. And in so doing, we actually free up an opportunity for girls to be who they need to be and yet take responsibility for who they are becoming. So I really appreciate our conversation. I appreciate your wisdom. And I thank you so much for joining us today, Rosalind.
Wonderful.
You've been listening to The Connected Girl, a podcast produced by the International Coalition of Girls' Schools to address real issues that impact the lives of girls we know. This episode is the fourth in a series of podcasts engaging listeners to think about the many ways that the connections in girls' lives keep them whole and healthy and let them know they matter. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Connected Girl on the ICGS's podcast channel on educating girls so that you can check out the rest of the series. Thanks for listening. It's important to the girls in your lives that you do. The International Coalition of Girls' Schools created this series in true partnership with Two Stories, podcast production by Carol Williams with audio editing, engineering, and sound design by Rebecca Fancel. Thanks to all the girls featured in the audio clips in these episodes of the Connected Girls series. For more information, please refer to the show notes.